You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, August 11th, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Dan Cannon, author of Pleading Out, How Plea Bargaining Creates a Permanent Criminal Class. Meanwhile, the FBI probe into what appears to be a January 6th related investigation is ramping up. After the Mar-a-Lago raid and seizing election denier Representative Scott Perry's phone, more subpoenas are being sent out to Pennsylvania state legislators who tried to reverse election results. We're cooking up something. Lindsey Graham has joined Rudy Giuliani in refusing to comply with Georgia's subpoena for his testimony. Hard for him to use Giuliani's doctor's note excuse. I can't travel. It's bad, Giuliani. I was trying to get his dentures in, but South Carolina shares a border, buddy. Lindsey Graham, drive on down. Gas prices have fallen below $4 in a nationwide average after peaking mid-June at over $5. The Fed is still going forward with hiking interest rates again, even though inflation is softening, which could really, affect potential homeowners going forward and not in a good way. Janet Yellen has directed the IRS to use its new funds only to investigate those making over $400,000, the new funds coming from the Inflation Reduction Act. Another day, another article about Biden weighing options on student loan debt by any means. Like, move at a glacial pace. People, it's just ridiculous, but...
Well, what have they been doing? Why is that news?
I don't know. I mean...
Just after previously forgetting about it before...
The August 31st deadline is approaching until they decide on another deadline. Washington Congressman Jamie Herrera Butler has officially conceded to Trump-endorsed Joe Kent in her primary. She was one of 10 House Republicans to vote yes on impeachment, and that makes 3 out of 10 who have already lost their primaries. Europe is once again suffering from a heat wave with forest fires in France and fish dying en masse in the rivers of Germany and Poland. And here in the U.S., July broke records on hot nights.
Records all over the place. Hottest nights you yet can imagine here at Mar-a-Lago.
In more ways than one. And lastly, the DOJ has charged an Iranian citizen with planning to murder John Bolton because Bolton was a part of Trump's successful assassination attempt of government official in Iran, Qasem Soleimani. An extrajudicial assassination of a government official by a foreign power, that is beyond the pale. Mm-hmm. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, everybody. It's a Majority Report Thursday. We stand on ceremony here. Happy to be here with you all today. I'm very excited about this guest. As I often am, but in particular today, because I think this book is really good. I am amused, and of course I don't want John Bolton killed, but I am amused by the gall that he has within him and that people treat this as. Like, yeah, when we assassinated Soleimani and decided just to call him a terrorist, that was the equivalent of Iran just assassinating John Bolton if he were in a foreign country. That is exactly what happened. It's exactly analogous.
Yeah, I mean, it's don't play games where you don't want to like involve yourself. Like, I don't know. Just
play stupid games, win stupid prizes.
Yeah, like I'm just shrugging my shoulders over here because it's like, this is the world that you are authoring, John Bolton.
It's the same thing when he said, you know, when he talked about the coups that he helped orchestrate, and he was like, that's not for here. We do that elsewhere. We do that in other countries, and we help them. We help right-wing coups all across the globe. But that's not allowed to happen here. It is fundamental to his worldview, is that we are exempt from the standards that we apply to the rest of the world. It's like, I can't think of anybody who personifies the arrogance of American exceptionalism more than John Bolton, but luckily he's not in power anymore.
Neither could some Iranians, apparently.
Yeah. I mean, the only reason that we did not enter into a massive conflict with Iran was because of Iranian restraint and because their leadership was way more sound and thoughtful than the United States.
And I'll just say I'll be in first in line to exhibit the same restraint on our end if that happened to John Bolton.
Yes, exactly. So the fallout from the raid on Mar-a-Lago continues, and we've seen a variety of different tactics that the right wing has tried to deploy and narratives, including the one that they seem to be zeroing in on, probably from the directive of Trump himself, that they brought backpacks and backpacks of planted evidence into the golden halls of Florida's Mar-a-Lago, which probably means to me, like, they found something, right? If you have to start at square one with the planted evidence narrative, that means that evidence will come out that makes you look bad, and so you have to call the evidence fake. The electors are fake, the election's fake.
These fake call logs, they're faking these things.
I mean,
they brought it in with a backpack, too.
And that makes it shadier.
Because it can only be documents, right? Like, what other objects are they planting in Mar-a-Lago? Did they need backpacks?
I'm unclear. That was Ainsley Earhart's spin on the same narrative. But the other thing that they're doing, and it's spearheaded by Rudy Giuliani, who's confined to his, again, cartoonishly old man mahogany office, because he said that he's too sick to travel down to Georgia to face a subpoena there, which is hogwash, but that's beside the point. That's one of the many probes into Donald Trump and the election interference that's happening right now. But he joined a Dr. Gino Loudon on Real America Voice.
Loudon?
Yes, right. Oh, no, she's come up multiple times. This is the woman that faked her degree. Yeah. Okay. And Dr. Gino Loudon. And he went on her program basically to say, Donald Trump's doing great. He's actually happier than ever. It reeks of like your ex posting about how much fun they're having without you on Instagram. This is Rudy Giuliani telling your ex that actually Trump's way better off. He's actually having the best time of his life right now.
President's doing great. I called him last night expecting that I was going to have to bolster him up. And first thing he said to me is, I think they've gone too far. I said, I think they've gone too far, too. This is going to
sounds like him.
Look at all those people in front of Mar-a-Lago. Look at all those people. He said, our people understand what happened. They understand it. Don't worry. I said, well, I'm calling you to tell you that.
Look at all those people. Like, Trump, he's got the options, baby. You know, you really missed out. He's got options. He's talking to the FBI, I guess, there. He's so happy. He's chilling. He's got anybody that he wants. He's happier off, actually, now that he knows that the FBI is looking into him in terms of trying to overturn the election. He's better.
This is reminiscent of late Nixon Nixon tapes, which are, you know, available online. I recommend people, if they have a free afternoon this summer, go listen to some of those, because Nixon is drunk often. When he's going through Watergate stuff, you can hear the cocktail glass with ice cubes in it rattle on the desk because the recorder's inside the desk. And so many of his phone calls are people calling him up and say, you did great in that speech, sir. Like, everyone's really great behind you. I think you really put this matter to bed. And just basically blowing smoke up his ass. And I think that's where we're at with Trump.
Rudy Giuliani is the primary perpetrator of smoke ass blowing. That's real, and he doesn't. He's one of the last people that Trump's got here, and probably because they're tied together as they have the concrete block tied to their feet, and they're sinking into the water. Like, they are going down with the ship, not to mix metaphors. But Giuliani did mention that there were people outside of Mar-a-Lago rallying for Trump and showing their fealty to him. Here's a little bit of that from a CNN report done by Randy Kay, speaking to Trump supporters outside of Mar-a-Lago. You know, there are other, better ways to spend your afternoon, but they decide to go out in the scorching heat in Florida in August to stand outside Mar-a-Lago.
I didn't get it the third time with January 6th. I think they know they're running out of time there. They raid a home, and CNN cameras are there and some of his past people. They know what's going on. It's all for a show to make Trump so he cannot run again.
You don't think that there was a real reason to come
here?
No, it's just a show.
It's not even think. I know there's no real reason. I know it in my heart. I know it in my spirit. He has never lied about anything.
I like that phrasing at the end because she knows it in her heart. Does she have evidence to back this up? No. Does all the evidence show that Donald Trump lies probably more than he takes breaths in a day? Yes. But look, it's like a religious fealty to him, and that, I think, is indicative of
that. Yeah, just believe in me.
Yeah, this is like pure, this is pure vibrational politics. Like, this is
well said.
This is pure hers. Like, she's like, I actually do not care if he's functionally lied. In my spirit, he is truthful.
The vibes are that he never lies to me.
The vibes are true. The vibes are real.
Man, it is going to be interesting to see what the response is from Trump supporters, because I found the reaction on, like, the mainstream press that we got to be really afraid of violence. And there have been, by the way, death threats sent to the judge, or at least talked about on 4chan-like forums, who approved that this warrant of search Mar-a-Lago.
And then the cops can do their jobs then.
Yeah, I also just think his personal aggrievement and make it's all Ryan Cooper made this point last Friday. When Trump ran in 2016, it was messaging that was pseudo populist about draining the swamp, building the wall. I'm going to bring you all health care, he would say. It was garbage and nonsense, and he was lying. But you could understand that the appeal was there for some people because it was facing towards the American public. Now, all of it is just about his own treatment and being treated unfairly. And Ryan Cooper compared it to how Hillary ran in 2016. I am owed this. And Trump is saying, I am owed the presidency. And it is the ravings of a lunatic, and it's the result of his massive ego. But I don't necessarily think that brings people into the streets in the same way now that we're 2 years removed in a violent way, right? Like we saw on January 6th. I don't know that, but I just think I'm starting to see a slow bleed out here in terms of that energy when it's just about
the raid of Mar-a-Lago. That's not a great symbol. The Capitol on January 6th is a better symbol for them because it's like we're trying to take back a stolen election in their minds. But Donald Trump getting his mansion in Florida raided, like, okay, you, again, like I said this yesterday, you want to make that Fort Sumter, like, good luck. Like, that's, like, symbolically, like, you're going to, January 6th already lost a lot of, I think, not entirely ideologically engaged Republican voters. And, you know, any sort of violence in retaliation for Trump, you know, getting raided because he, like, flushing toilets, or flushing documents on the toilet, like, that's not gonna, no one feels like that this is the new Boston Tea Party.
Right, yeah. And those Republican voters you mentioned that I think felt icky about that, a lot of them will come back if Trump's the nominee to vote for him.
Mm-hmm.
But the energy behind it to spread more wildly beyond that cohort, I'm just not seeing it right now. And I'm skeptical that it'll ever return.
And it might. I mean, look, political violence might happen. It happens in America. There's a lot of, like, amped up crazy people because that's a, you know, Republican Party strategy. Somebody might do something. And, like, look, we've been actually not defunding the police, but increasing their budgets, and they can get off their asses and do their jobs.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will be joined by Dan Cannon. We are back, and we are joined now by Dan Cannon, civil rights lawyer, law professor at the University of Louisville in Kentucky, and author of Pleading Out, How Plea Bargaining Creates a Permanent Criminal Class. Dan, thanks so much for being here today.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks so much for having me.
Of course. So let's give everybody a quick rundown of plea deals, if you don't mind, especially for listeners outside of the U.S. who might not be fully familiar with this practice, which is amazingly ubiquitous. How do they work, and how widespread are they here?
Well, it's amazingly ubiquitous in the United States, right? We resolve about 97% of all criminal cases with a plea bargain, with a guilty plea that is usually a result of a bargained agreement between a defense lawyer and a prosecutor, right? And so sometimes they are wheeling and dealing about what charges a defendant ought to face. And sometimes we call that charge bargaining, and sometimes it's wheeling and dealing over what sort of penalties a defendant might face, which we call sentence bargaining. And it's important to understand that no place else in the world does it the way that we do, because we've given prosecutors so much leeway to use any sort of bargaining tactics, any carrot, any stick. And that's a lot of what's resulted in this high number of plea bargain cases. The rest of the world tops out at maybe 80% at the highest, but we're much higher than that.
So a lot of this is due to immense prosecutorial discretion, and I think you could argue, I believe you do very effectively, scales tilted very much in favor of the prosecution, particularly when the defendant is poorer, and that's when they're more likely to take some of these plea deals. What are some of the power dynamics at play now that we're at this astronomical figure of 97% of guilty pleas coming through this process?
Sure. Well, what you're looking at here is a system that has essentially been built for speed and nothing else, right? You know, when people conceptualize what our criminal justice system is about, right? I should call it a criminal legal system because there's really nothing just about it. We think of, you know, what we see on television. You think about trials and procedurals and these intense fact-finding missions and a search for the truth. When in reality, it's become a bureaucratic process, right? And what we've developed over the last 200 years is a system that operates on the principle of speed above all else. We are trying to convict as many people as quickly as we possibly can and sweep them into this massive criminal class. When you look at the outcomes, criminal justice outcomes in the United States versus the whole rest of the world, you know, we do plea bargaining way more than anybody else. We also convict more people. We lock more people up. Our arrest rates are much higher than other countries that have similar legal systems. And you have to wonder why. Well, in the book, what I lay out is the plea bargaining is the why. That is the mechanism that has allowed so many people to get swept into this enormous criminal class since we started the practice in the 1830s.
So let's go to the 1830s there, because that was so fascinating to me to do a dive into the origins of plea deals and how they came to be. I did not realize that it started in the 1830s. So in New England, take us through that time period and how this began.
It's very brave of you to ask a law professor to go all the way back to the 19th century and say, just go. I assume we have limited time on this segment, so I'll try to make it.
Honestly, we don't. And so this part was really honestly the most fascinating element to me. So I'd love if you could expand on this as much as you see fit.
Yeah, so I think what's really important for your viewers to understand is that plea bargaining was initiated as a tactic to undermine the labor movement, right? We don't think about it that way. We don't see it play out that way now, but that's what it was. So if you go back to the 1830s in New England, which is when scholars think plea bargaining really started in America, at that time, you've got this enormous rise in the working class and rise in power of the working class, right? The first Federation of Labor Unions was formed in New York in 1834. And you've got universal white male suffrage. So you have, you know, working class, unlanded white men for the first time sitting on juries all over the country. And juries were enormously powerful. So what the courts were trying to do at that time, what the ruling classes were trying to do was prosecute people, workers who were organizing. So they were trying to prosecute them as groups. And when they became too big to continue doing that, the courts had to find new strategies for sweeping lots of people into the criminal class, right? For what they started to do was criminalize the behaviors of individual workers. So you see all these prosecutions under these gigantic and vague statutes like drunken disorderly or vagrancy or whatever. You see these individual prosecutions start to happen in lieu of prosecuting groups of workers. And what happens along with that, as a result of doing that and by instituting plea bargaining, you're able to sweep the same number of workers into a big criminal class so they're alienated from their communities and everybody else, and you take juries out of the equation. Right, so the juries were becoming more and more sympathetic to working class people. And so there's like, well, okay, let's not have any more jury trials. Let's come up with a quick and easy way to get all these convictions, and we'll make it seem like the working class people that are getting charged with these things have a stake in the matter, that they can just strike a deal with the state, right? And over time, that grew into being the main method, really the only method at this point, for resolving criminal cases. If you look at, you know, our numbers essentially indicate that the jury trial, for all intents and purposes, is dead and has been dead since the early 19th century, way before women could ever sit on juries, way before people of color could ever sit on juries, right? The idea of a jury of one's peers has never really happened in the criminal context in the United States.
That is, yeah, I think that breaks the brains of a lot of people, given the mythology about our criminal justice system in the United States. Like, I mean, I was just talking about Law and Order is being filmed in Brooklyn. I just walked by it today, going to work. And that's the entirety of our cultural perception about trials and the fairness of it, jury of your peers. And In 2022, they've largely been cut out of the equation.
They don't happen. And because they happen so infrequently, think about the kind of juries that we do see now, right? You know, back in the 1830s, you're just starting to see working class juries, right? And before that, it was just a certain kind of person that got on a jury. And we like to think that we've evolved since then. But look at who sits on juries now. If you look at the statistics on who sits on a jury, it's mostly upper middle class white people who can afford to be there for, you know, X amount of days, right? And we have so few jury trials that we can be very selective about who ends up on a jury, and we are, right? You know, so there's a study out of Houston that says only 20% of the people who are called to jury duty in the first place even show up, because those are the people who can afford it, or who have, you know, who are interested enough to show up, or who don't think it's just a drag and a waste of time, right? And those folks tend to be upper middle class white people. So they're the ones that end up on the juries time and time and time again. Again, you end up with these juries that look nothing like a cross section of the community, and certainly nothing like most of the people that are getting charged with crimes.
And so let's go back a little bit to the labor movement discussion, and how, so in the 1830s, if I'm not mistaken, that the population in New England was starting to really explode pretty quickly because of the Industrial Revolution, which that's really when the United States labor movement does begin to develop. The juries then, with that new explosion of population, was it partly because the juries were beginning to be filled with working class people who were setting precedent that was beneficial to other working class people, and that was an attempt to claw that back?
Yes, 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 indeed. So you see two things happen in the 19th century, right, in New England specifically. At that time, juries were enormously powerful. So we think about, you know, juries are very powerful now. It's the most power you can have for most of us as citizens. But back then they were even more powerful because they decided issues of fact and issues of law, right? Today we think of the jury as the fact finder. When you talk to lawyers about what a jury does, the jury is a finder of fact. And the judge decides what the law is. The judge gives the instruction to the jury about the law, and then the jury finds a fact. So, you know, if the case is about whether or not somebody ran a red light, the jury determines the ultimate fact of whether or not that person ran the red light. Well, in the 19th century, they decided issues of law. So this is a terrible example to use for the 19th century, but roll with it. If they would have said that whether or not it was illegal to run the red light, right, you know, in the first place, so they can determine issues of law. And it's very dangerous to give that kind, if you're the ruling classes, it's a very dangerous to give that kind of power to regular working class guys who don't have land and who, you know, have unwashed, calloused hands and this whole thing. So they start to, the first thing that happens is they take that power, the power to determine issues of law, away from juries. And you see in the literature at the time, like, juries are stupid. They're too dumb to do this stuff. Let's take this, let's leave this power to the judges. And so all of that power to decide issues of law is consolidated in judges. And at the same time, they're working on ways to just take all criminal cases, but all criminal cases away from juries. And what I argue is that the plea bargain was the primary mechanism that they used to do that. Plea bargains are quick. They're easy. You go in for, you know, 2 minutes and you do a little bit of back and forth, and the state has a gun to your head. So you're going to take whatever offer they have on the table, and everybody's done. It's, you don't have to go through the mess or the expense or the time or the embarrassment in some cases of a trial. So that's been very appealing to both sides over the years. But what I argue is that the net effect is that all this plea bargaining has removed the public from the processes of criminal justice altogether. And that's done a lot of harm to our democracy.
So essentially, juries were deciding what the law would be in that time period. And that was a level of direct democracy it's not even democracy, but maybe it is.
It is.
Yeah, I guess I shouldn't even couch it. A level of direct democracy that made the powers that be a bit uncomfortable, which is fascinating. And it they took that right away in the 1850s. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah. So if you look at what was going on in Massachusetts, this was a big debate at the time. I actually didn't know this until I started researching for the book, because we've taken it for granted. You know, American lawyers take it for granted. Juries are the finders of fact, and that's just what they do. Judges always instruct on the law. But it just wasn't that way in the early 19th century. And this was a big debate at the Massachusetts Constitutional Convention. There was a lot of this. Well, if you're just, you know, you're taking power away from the people. Some legislators argued this. You're taking power away from the people and giving it to judges. And that's undemocratic, and we shouldn't do that. But that's what happened. The legislatures ultimately took that power away from juries and gave it to judges. And at the same time, you have all this stripping away of the number of trials that are happening in the first place. And that happened at an enormous rate. So if you think about the 1830s, you know, plea bargaining was taboo. Before 1830, it was illegal. It was unheard of to do that kind of thing. And prosecutors would get prosecuted for trying to make deals with defendants. So 0% plea bargaining rate in 1830. By 1850, that's jumped to 50% of the criminal cases decided in Massachusetts. And by the 1880s, you're up to 88% of all criminal cases decided in Massachusetts, subject to a plea bargain. And, you know, to go back to what I said earlier, you're looking at 1880, you know, there's essentially no more criminal trials in Massachusetts, and women are not allowed to serve on a jury until 1950 in Massachusetts. So the idea that we've ever had a jury of one's peers In this country is ridiculous, because the practice spread like wildfire, especially during Prohibition, when everybody was, you know, just crazy for getting criminal convictions to go as fast as possible, because there was just so much new crime made all of a sudden as a result of the 18th Amendment. And what you've seen over time is just the almost the total death of the jury trial and the removal of the community from criminal justice.
Was it always the case that the prosecution was essentially allowed to handpick jurors based on what they thought would be best for their case?
Well, so there's always a been a voir dire process, right? So that's something that we got from English common law, and that's been around for a long time. So, you know, the lawyers get to pick jurors, right? And they've had less leeway to do that for wrong reasons over time, right? So, you know, one of the things that I mean, if you look at where we were in the 1880s, right, when all these jury trials are disappearing, you also have a situation in which prosecutors and the lawyers that are trying the cases have a lot of leeway in terms of what jurors they pick. They have less now, but it's important to note that, you know, we started imposing those restrictions long after the death of the jury trial. So, for example, there's a case that every lawyer knows or should know called Batson versus Kentucky. And in that case, that was the first time that the Supreme Court ever said that a prosecutor or some other lawyer on a criminal case can't remove a juror just because of their race. Right. So in other words, these prosecutors were striking black people, using peremptory strikes just to take black people off juries. And the Supreme Court says you can't do that anymore. That opinion wasn't rendered until 1986, right? Long after the death of the jury trial for all intents and purposes in America, long after the beginning of the drug war, long after the onset of Prohibition and all the things that drove the death of the jury trial and this sort of takeover of plea bargaining in the 20th century.
Can you expand on the Prohibition point that you made there, at how that increased criminalization for substances? Because that's also when we create the infrastructure for the war on drugs, which explodes, of course, Nixon and Reagan.
Sure. Yeah. So the federal government was not really involved in criminal prosecution all that much prior to Prohibition. Right. So when Prohibition takes effect, prior to that time, crime is sort of thought of as a local problem. But then crime, in scare quotes, explodes overnight. Right. And you have, you know, President Hoover and all these other figures coming out and saying, look, we've got to do something about this, because now all of a sudden we've got all this crime and we've got to go after the bootleggers and the people who are enabling the bootleggers and the people who enable the people who enable the bootleggers. And it's not just the bootleggers, folks. It's everybody. Everybody's doing crime everywhere. And so we've got to be able to stamp this out. We've got to be able to, you know, due process is nice, but we've got to be able to do it quickly. So what happens is the federal government gets involved in criminal prosecutions in a way that it never had before. The agency that eventually becomes the FBI, it explodes. They add thousands of new agents to that. The federal prison population triples during the period of Prohibition. From I think by 1933, the population had tripled in just 13 years. And, you know, there's just all this capacity for the federal government to enforce these laws. And then Congress gets on board. It's like, okay, well, we've got all these toys, right? You know, the federal government has this capacity. Now, we should start making more crime for them to go after and make it easier for them to do their jobs and prosecute under. So they're passing crime bill after crime bill after crime bill, even when Prohibition goes away. This is the important piece, right? When Prohibition proves to be unsustainable, they take it away. But that next year, after the 21st Amendment passes, Congress passes 9 new federal crime bills, like these omnibus crime bills that will allow federal law enforcement, these new this new mechanism that they've created for the federal government to enforce the law. Now it has something to do, right? You know, since Prohibition's gone ahead, it needs something to do. So they pass all these new crime bills. And the and President Roosevelt's attorney general gives this address where he's like, well, look, the number one thing, the number one threat to the fabric of American society is narcotics. It's not alcohol anymore. Now it's narcotics, right? And that's sort of the beginning seeds of the drug war that really took off, as you say, during the Nixon and Reagan eras.
And a lot of I don't know if everyone realizes how in this time period, too, specific drugs were stereotypically linked to different racial groups. There's a reason that cannabis became marijuana. There's a reason that there were articles in Southern papers and also in Northern papers about I think particularly in the Louisiana area about black men who were able to stay up all night because of cocaine and rape your women, and then opium being associated with Asian American immigrants, and that was, I think, a way to launder that infrastructure from the Prohibition era as a way to target racial minority groups in this country from even before the drug war. That was the infrastructure.
Yes, indeed. And think about plea bargaining's role in this. This is the thing I talk a lot about in the book. Because we've made a system that is really unconcerned with fact finding, with truth seeking, or any sort of processes, because we've made a system that is fundamentally concerned with speed above all else. We've also that requires a lot of discretion, right? A lot of discretion by law enforcement, a lot of discretion by prosecutors, because if the police go out to arrest somebody, they're pretty sure, right? 9.7 times out of 10, that arrest is going to end in some kind of conviction, because the prosecutor has so much power, right? So they're going to use some kind of carrot, some kind of stick. They're going to keep them in jail for forever, or they're going to jack up the charges, or they're going to do whatever to get them to plead guilty to something. So police are less careful, and they know that they're never, in most cases, they're never even going to have to present any kind of evidence or give any kind of testimony or be put under any kind of truthoscope, right? So if you have a cop that's a racist cop that just decides, I want to go out and arrest only black people, I'm never going to arrest white people ever. And that's what they go out and do. Well, it's very difficult to hold them accountable, because lo and behold, all those arrests end up in a conviction of some kind, right? And so the police officer, no matter how racist they are, they're vindicated in their actions. They're vindicated in their racism by the system, because it's just set up to result in a conviction of some kind, no matter what. And so, great job. You did your job. You made an arrest, and that arrest ended in a conviction. Same goes for prosecutors. If prosecutors just decide, I'm going to prosecute all the black people on my docket more harshly, what stops them from doing that? Right. You know, so you jack up the charges. You can threaten them with anything. You could threaten them with, you know, extensive prison sentences at higher charges and compounded sentences and death. Even you could put the death penalty on the table for some defendants. And you're going to do that more harshly, as we've seen time and time again. Prosecutors do this more harshly for people of color. And what stops them from doing that? Nothing, because all of these prosecutions, virtually all of them, end in convictions of some kind.
In fact, I mean, the incentives actually go the other way, because the more convictions you get, the more successful your department is perceived as. The same thing with cops, right? There's financial incentives for them, arrests-wise. So it's a beast that feeds one another, and it's your book and your analysis makes me realize that just criticism of cops and the policing in this country as an institution is insufficient when the other side of this is also the prosecution that feeds off of that very system.
Yeah. And what's really interesting is if you look at the example in Alaska that I talk a lot about in the book, or if you look at New Orleans, there's some other jurisdictions that have experimented with a reduction in plea bargaining in discrete periods of time. In Alaska, This is the clearest example. In Alaska, you've got an attorney general that comes in that has a lot of control because of the way state law is and says, well, we're just going to clamp down on plea bargaining. All the plea bargaining is going to go through me. We're going to do a whole lot less. We're going to have a whole lot more trials. And everyone's freaking out. This is in the 1970s. Everyone's freaking out because, oh, how are we going to do this? There's too much crime and it's just going to crash the system. And there's no way we can handle all these trials. And there's just no way we can do this without plea bargaining virtually everything. And that turned out to be not true. And in fact, it had a very positive effect on the system overall. When you talk to, and I talked to a bunch of the lawyers that were around during that period of time, they said, yes, trials did go up. The number of trials did go up quite a bit, but also the number of charges went down. So what happens is prosecutors are forced, if they can't plead all these cases and just run a, you know, this sort of bureaucratic mill of conviction after conviction after conviction, if they have to look at the cases and assume that they're going to take them to trial, they get a whole lot more selective about what they prosecute. And in fact, in Alaska, what happened was prosecutors went from rejecting 4% of the cases that police brought to them to rejecting 44% overnight. You know, when this new policy was put in place. Of course, this makes police very mad, and it makes prosecutors and police do this for a time. You know, it makes them fight each other because, you know, these police are bringing them all these arrests. And, you know, unlike before where they could just bring them anything and walk away with a conviction almost for sure, prosecutors are saying, look, I'm not going to take that. You know, we're just going to dismiss this. This is a terrible case. You didn't cross your T's. You didn't dot your I's. I don't have good enough evidence here. But over time, even the police in Alaska say, well, this is actually better because it's forcing us to do better police work and bring in cases that we know we can get convictions on and, you know, to have charges that more accurately reflect the bad conduct that we arrested somebody for in the first place. So it had an enormous system-wide effect in Alaska for a short period of time. And then a new attorney general came in and changed everything back to the way it was.
So, yeah, going back through our historical timeline a bit, I do just want to touch on the war on drugs era and maybe bring us to the present and how that affected the whole plea bargaining process.
Yeah, well, during the period of the war on drugs, it's kind of you have one of those things of the means sort of justifying the ends, I suppose. What I mean by that is whereas in the pre-drug war era, courts were not exactly sure if they wanted to have a criminal justice system that was based exclusively on, you know, haggling in the back rooms of courthouses. They weren't sure how much power they wanted to give to prosecutors to reach a plea agreement at whatever cost. And so you see a lot of disagreement within academia. You see a lot of, you know, conversation about this topic among lawyers on the ground. And there was a national commission on criminal defense that actually recommended that all plea bargaining be done away with by 1978. Obviously that didn't happen. The courts went the other direction. The courts were essentially issuing opinions, the Supreme Court especially, issuing opinions to accommodate the speed of the system, to make it easier for prosecutors to get convictions, to make it easier for defendants to plead, or harder to resist the plea bargain, I should say. And then finally, in the 1970s, you have this case called Bordenkercher versus Hayes. And what that case stands for, you have, and this is from right here in Kentucky, you've got a defendant who gets charged with writing a bad check. And the prosecutor comes to him and says, you're going to do 5 years. You've got a prior felony from 10 years ago. So you're going to do 5 years over this bad check. And Mr. Hayes says, I don't want to do 5 years over this bad check. That seems a lot of time to do for an $80 check, you know. And the prosecutor says, well, if you don't do 5 years, you don't take the 5-year deal and these are his words, you make the court go through the inconvenience of a trial, then I'm going to hit you with this life sentence, right? And it's what we call the trial penalty now, right? For having the audacity to take a case to trial, you get hit with something even higher. So I'm going to hit you with these higher charges, these habitual offender charges, and you're going to do life. That's a mandatory life sentence. And Mr. Hayes says, thank you, but no thank you. I'll take my chances with the jury. The jury convicts him, and he gets a life sentence for an $80 check. And, you know, this is just the way we do things now, right? You talk to lawyers that are within the criminal justice system that have been doing criminal practice for a while. They know this is the way we do things, and we take it for granted. But back then, it was controversial. This case goes all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court says, well, it's the prosecutor's job to get a defendant to give up their right to trial, right? To relinquish their right to trial. To, you know, it's their job to bargain with them. And if the defendant doesn't want to make that deal, then that's fine. But you take your lumps, right? No matter what they are. So it's perfectly fine for you to get a life sentence for an $80 check. We don't see any problem with that. And that really throws open the floodgates. To my way of thinking, we don't teach that case that much in law schools. But to my way of thinking, that is a turning point in American history, because whatever resistance there was that courts had or prosecutors had to, you know, just no holds barred plea bargaining at that time went away after the Hayes case.
Well, it is a fundamentally imbalanced contract, between somebody who's been arrested, has a criminal record hanging over their heads, and a prosecutor who has immense discretion and has the ability to put that person in prison. And it seems like the way that it's been treated, it's like it's a freedom of contract in between two parties, informally, really, within our own judicial system. But there's this retaliatory element that is completely accepted. Like, you made my job harder by exercising your constitutional rights. So here you go. This is what you deserve.
Yeah. Yeah. The courts that have tackled this have come to a place that I think is very silly over, you know, since the Hayes case. And, you know, that's within the last 50 years. They just say, well, this is a contract between the state and the defendant. And it's just like anything. It's like buying a used car, or like, you know, haggling over the price of a DVD at a flea market or something like that. Only we're talking about decades of someone's life.
Yeah.
And you talk about retaliatory measures. And I tell people, I've been doing this book tour, and I tell lay people that, you know, prosecutors can threaten a defendant with death if they exercise their right to a trial. Like, ha, 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 yeah, that's hyperbolic, canon. That's very funny. You don't mean to say that a prosecutor can actually threaten someone with death, like actual physical death. But that's exactly what happens. And lawyers, just criminal lawyers, just sort of take this for granted. If you don't take the deal that's on the table, the death penalty gets on the table. And that makes the stakes even higher, right? Because then you have to have a death qualified jury, and it gets very messy. And the likelihood that your client's going to get popped at least with a life sentence, you know, let alone death, by a jury like that, goes up exponentially. And the statistics on this, there's a lot of chilling statistics in this book. But the statistics on this one really have stuck with me. 75% of all the people that have been put on death row since the 1970s, 75% of them could have avoided a death sentence by taking a plea offer, right? By pleading guilty. In other words, if they'd have taken the offer that the prosecutor put on the table, usually a life sentence offer, right? If in the cases of terrible murder. Prosecutor offers life. They say, no, I don't want life. I want to go to trial. Then the death penalty gets on the table, right? 75% of those cases are like that. And you think about the people that, you know, if you oppose the death penalty, which I do, you still want to think that, all right, you know, we have this terribly outdated thing that we do in the United States. We put people to death, but it's only reserved for the worst of the worst of the worst people that who commit the most heinous crimes. But if you think about the people who refuse to take the offer that a prosecutor gives them in a serious murder case, it's usually either, you know, the criminally insane, and there are people out there like that, of course, or people who are factually innocent, who really didn't do it, right? So I think if you look at those numbers, you look at those statistics, it suggests something very different than we're just putting the worst of the worst to death.
So I guess it's a, would be a good time to talk about the second part of your title, the creation of a permanent criminal class. What are some of the other jarring statistics about the result of this system, and what are some of the ramifications that I know some people might be familiar with, but taken in totality, this entire population that's been, that's gone through this system, what are the effects?
So I think maybe a good way to frame this is by looking at the difference between arrest rates. You know, if you look at the arrest rate in the United States versus other common law countries, other countries that have legal systems similar to ours, Canada, the UK, Australia. Yeah, look at the arrest rate in the UK. It's 1,400 people, roughly 1,400 people per every 100,000 get arrested every year. Right? In Canada, it's 600. Right? 600 people for every 100,000. For us, it's 3,000, more than twice what it is in Britain. Right? And so you look at those kind of statistics and you think, well, what's going on here? Is there something, I think, you know, you come to one of two conclusions. Either there's something special about Americans that makes us, you know, uniquely predisposed to criminal behavior. It's too much sex on TV. It's violent video games. It's high fructose corn syrup, whatever it is. Right. Or you can accept that there's a mechanism that is making more criminals faster in the U.S. And my argument is that that mechanism chiefly is the plea bargain. There's a few of them, but the plea bargain.
Or it's just a people's pathology here in the United States. We're just we're just full of criminals and we all suck, right? Apparently.
Yeah. We're just so we're fundamentally different as human beings from people in Canada and the UK. And that's just how they are. We're just more likely to be criminals.
It's all the freedom in the water.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, it's when you look at those kind of statistics and then you think about the original purposes for the institution of plea bargaining, the relaxation of restrictions on plea bargaining back in the 1830s, which, as I've argued, is to undermine the labor movement. Well, what does slapping a criminal label on that many people do? Right now, one-third, almost a complete one-third of all adults in the United States have some kind of arrest or conviction record, right? It's huge. It's a massive number of people. And it's, you know, every human civilization in the world has had a criminal class of some kind, right? We all know what that means for it to have, you know, this sort of separate box that we put our criminals into. And these are the people that you stay away from. And these are the people that you don't let your kids hang around. And these are the people that you don't open a business with and that sort of thing, right? So we've retained that ancient stigma in the United States. We still know what it means to be part of the criminal class. But what we've done is we've just swept an enormous number of people into that. More, we've expanded and amplified the boundaries of that criminal class to more people than any other civilization in the history of the world, right? And we don't really care what somebody was convicted of. We just know that they're part of the criminal class. You look at the psychological studies that have been done on people that have had the criminal label slapped on them. And it's profound. You know, the difference between somebody who has been accused of a crime and somebody who has been convicted of a crime is huge, both in the way that they interact with other, that society interacts with them and the way that they interact with society, right? So somebody who's been convicted of something, somebody who's been labeled a criminal and swept into that criminal class is more likely to engage in further criminal behaviors. They're less likely to participate in civic activities of any kind. They're more likely to take on all sorts of antisocial behaviors. So we don't want to play with them anymore and they don't want to play, period, right? And what has that done to, when you apply that to a full third of the population, what has that done to working class solidarity in this country over the last 200 years? Well, I mean, compare our labor movement to every other labor movement in the world. It would be silly to say that plea bargaining is the cause for the difference in, you know, the sort of social welfare safety net that the working class has been able to get for itself here in the United States and versus every other country in the world. But I don't think it's far-fetched to say that it's a cause. You know, it's a factor in that.
Well, it's something I learned from you is that it is in its origins that was part, that was what it was designed to do. Yes. The fact that this mass acceptance of plea deals was born out of an attempt to break working class solidarity in the midst of the Industrial Revolution in New England is, I think, very instructive for people trying to understand the churn of our criminal justice system today. And yeah. it, of course, it has different flavors or manifestations, like in the way that the drug laws are explicitly racist, but it is fundamentally designed to create to other the working class so that there isn't solidarity.
Absolutely. And it's hard for people to accept that, right? You know, it's hard for casual observers of the criminal justice system. It's hard for law students. It's hard for lawyers to accept it, right? Because you think, you know, if you look at the system up close and you're part of it and you see good people in it, and I think most of the people that work within the system are good people. Most, even the prosecutors, the defense attorneys, even some of the police, right, are good people. And you know, the point that I try to make in the book is you can put good people into a fundamentally bad system and still have bad outcomes, right? We want to look at the criminal justice system and say, well, look, there's a few bad apples in it, but this is still a pretty good system and it does what it's designed to do. And so we have some aberrations and we have some bad things that happen. And what I'm saying is the bad things are the norm. When good things happen out of the criminal justice system, that is the aberration, because it's not, you know, that is the system not working to preserve boundaries, class boundaries and race boundaries and that sort of thing, right? And if you look at the mechanisms that we've carried forward from when the courts were explicitly classist, I mean, I don't think that you can look at the Victorian period and say, you know, the courts weren't classist. Of course they were, and most people accept that. But I think the real question to ask is, when did that change? Like, when did we fundamentally just turn on our heels and say, we're going to have a new system now? That never happened. We pride ourselves on the sameness of the system, in fact. And so you get these mechanisms that are carried forward, like cash bail, like, hiring private attorneys if you want to choose who your attorney is, like the plea bargain, those mechanisms that were designed explicitly to stake boundaries between classes or races have been carried forward, and we still do them, right? We just don't think that since the people that are involved in it have no ill motive, then there's no problem with that.
It reminds me of kind of some conversations that people will have about how under J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI was racist and targeting black civil rights groups. It's like, yeah, it didn't change that much to this day, and there's way more continuity than there is shift. And recognition of something historically does not mean that the institutions change whatsoever. Like, I find it frustrating sometimes when we're talking about really changing things systemically that people see a historical understanding as a substitute for an actual overhaul of a system.
Yes. No, I agree with that 100%. And I get the question often, well, how do we fix this? You know, what is the way that we fix it? And I propose some fixes in the book. And I think there are ways that you can make, you know, that people can make grassroots change to the criminal justice system. But, you know, when you look at the thing in its ugly eye, it's really hard for me to imagine reform of this system as opposed to a rebuild, right? It's hard for me to imagine reform of this system that would work and make it something, you know, that results in what a sane person would call anything like justice.
Last question. I know I've kept you a bit over, if you don't mind. Do you mind just saying a bit about some of those possible reforms and then I'll let you go?
Well, sure. In terms of what people can do on the ground, what I've done in the last part of the book is to interview criminal justice organizers, really excellent criminal justice organizers that have been able to build coalitions on the ground to change public opinion about discrete issues of criminal justice. Right. And so what I've tried to do is to take their successes and make them into a blueprint for future successes. What works and what was your messaging strategy and how did you go about doing it? And so I boiled it down to a few principles that people could use. And if they, and if you know, a movement wanted to use this to restrict plea bargaining in a discrete area, you know, as I've said before, I think that could have a profound system-wide effect. If you increase the number of trials in an area just by 10 to 20%, we're at 97%, right? So if you go up to, 90%, right, or 85%, you've doubled or tripled the amount of resources that it takes to administer criminal justice. And it forces the system, you know, the sort of prevailing wisdom as long as I've been an attorney is, well, that's going to crash the system and it's going to cause criminal justice to come to a screeching halt. But what history shows is that that's not what happens. The system adapts and the system becomes smarter, and it forces prosecutors to develop priorities that are more in line, I think, with community norms and mores.
Dan Cannon, a civil rights lawyer, law professor at the University of Louisville in Kentucky, and you could get his book everywhere where books are sold, Pleading Out, How Plea Bargaining Creates a Permanent Criminal Class. We will put the links to your book, Dan, in the podcast description, YouTube description, others as well. I really can't thank you enough for this discussion. I really, really enjoyed it very much.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
All right, folks, with that, we are going to wrap up the first hour of this program. We will be heading into the fun half, taking your calls. But first, Matt, what's happening? I resist even saying this because it seems like it's, you know, Sam's catchphrase, but the Matt Leckian media universe.
Yeah, so we had Ben Spielberg on to talk about the Infrastructure Reduction Act and why the climate stuff is maybe a little bit underwhelming, and the probably the best thing is the tax sort of enforcement. We support that here. We're authoritarian that way against people with money. And also we talked about how the progressives need to figure out how to grow a backbone. So it's, you know, Bernie Sanders that they're going to figure out what is going to be changed about the bill at the end of it, and not Manchin and Sinema. Also tonight on both This Is Revolution and Left Reckoning's YouTube pages, we're going to be doing a new bi-monthly installment of Revolutionary Reckoning, where we just hang out and chat about the news. So check that out. It's on both, again, like Left Reckoning YouTube channel and the This Is Revolution YouTube channel. So that should be fun. David and I are both going to be hanging out with, I think, Pascal and Jason, maybe Gene.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so.
Awesome. By the way, folks, Matt Binder is out this week, so we will just be joined by Brandon Sutton. And we're going to be joined by him shortly. We have him in the waiting room, and we will hear what's happening on the discourse. But for Matt Binder and Absentia, check out Doomed, check out Scam Economy, especially if you want to rip into the crypto world for Scam Economy. It's a fun time to do that. Can we need a two-shot here, I believe.
Yeah.
All right. For now.
We'll do this for now.
What's up? Brandon, nice. Hi, Brandon. Kowalski shirt.
Oh, thank you. Is that what this is from?
No, yes, I wear that shirt to bed many nights. I appreciate it, Kowalski. Thanks so much for the merch.
I do too. I also want to say I appreciate it. It looks great. Really hugs my torso nicely. And so I appreciate you sending it out. It's very soft, very breathable.
Do you work out?
I try not to, but you know, sometimes a call to the gym is just too much to ignore.
What's happening not at your gym, but over on the discourse?
Well, you know, I think of the discourse as my mental gym, where I work out my brain muscle.
Insufferable.
The largest muscle in the body, for those of you who don't know. And this week we'll probably be talking about, because we have not met yet to discuss the happenings of this week, but we'll be talking about the raid, unjust or just, of our former president Trump's Mar-a-Lago golf estate. And, you know, I'm sure that will be a very tense conversation because of our differences of opinions on the criminal justice system.
Very, very interesting. Embrace debate.
So. Got to embrace debate. You got to, I don't know what it's called, that UATX, rational theory syndrome or whatever. I don't know. But yeah, embrace debate.
That too. 646-257-3920. We'll be reading your IMs and taking your calls. See you in the fun half.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now. And I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now. And I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now. But I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Who? What is up, everyone? Nomi Key.
You did it. Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false. No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this, 7A?
Yes.
Hi, Minnie? This
me? Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go for that
one. Libertarians.
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge Matt.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say.
857-210-3501.
1/2. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion. Sold. It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop.
You call it satire. Sam goes satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.